But tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time Kevin Griffin, the author of this new book, A Burning Desire, Dharma, God, and the Path of Recovery, as well as of this classic book, One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. Kevin is a leader, founder of the mindfulness recovery movement in Buddhism, and he has been working in the field of addiction treatment for decades. And we, Stuart and I, had the pleasure of doing an interview with him on our Mystical Positivist radio show a month or so ago, and it was great fun, so I'm really looking forward to this evening.
I should also mention that he's an accomplished musician.
He is an accomplished musician.
In the process of putting a CD out, and on the radio program that we recorded, there is actually a hint of his music. He played some music for us. So.
That's right, so you can go and download that radio show.
It's available today.
Exactly. But anyway, thank you so much, and welcome Kevin Griffin.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming up. Thanks, Rob and Stuart, for having me up. Nice to be invited to Sebastopol. I live in Berkeley, so I'm not a stranger to these parts. And I'm not exactly on a book tour. I work mostly as a meditation teacher and teach retreats and workshops and classes on the material in my books on Buddhism and recovery, 12 steps. I have a monthly class at Spirit Rock Meditation Center called Dharma and Recovery. so the one thing that I'm not used to is having to speak without having meditated first. I did meditate this morning, but
Feel free to lead us in a short.
Well, I thought maybe I would. Thank you. Good, nicely cued there. Right on cue. So that's why I set up the bell here. And I thought we'd just maybe for 5 minutes I'll lead a little meditation. Everybody looks like they're sitting comfortably. Just gently closing your eyes. Enjoy the sound of the bell. Just relaxing into the body, feeling your body breathing. Allowing sounds to come and go. Perhaps just noticing how you're feeling right now. What your mood is, what your energy is. Can you just be with that? Be aware of your mind and body and how they are right now. And not try to do anything about it. But just relax and accept the feelings, emotional, physical, the thoughts that come and go. While letting the breath be at the center of your experience as everything else moves through. So again, welcome. Today was a typical day. Picked up the New York Times this morning and there's an article about Amy Winehouse, the brilliant R&B singer, English R&B singer who died this summer. His family had said that the toxicology report showed that there were no drugs in her system, and the coroner reported today that she had the alcohol level four times above the legal driving limit when she died. She died of alcohol overdose. I got an email from an old friend of mine, a friend who, the first time that I smoked pot in 1967, he was my best friend. I called him the next day and said, "You've got to come over here. You've got to do this." And we got high together and smoked dope together for years. And his teenage daughter is now smoking dope constantly, and he's trying to figure out what to do about that because he doesn't do that anymore. He has cirrhosis from Hep C, from shooting dope. And then Terry Gross interviewed David Carr, who's a media columnist for the Times. And the second half of the interview was mostly talking about his history as a crack addict. And he has a book out about that. And Terry asked him, I understand that, I don't want to, ask a too personal question, but, I know that in the recovery world, there's this issue about higher power and God, and how do you deal with that? And so we got a talk from this New York Times columnist about how he manages the issue of higher power in his recovery program, which was quite interesting and kind of funny to me, particularly in his willingness to just say he goes to a Catholic mass and he's a practicing Catholic, but he said at one point, "I think it's perfectly okay to just have kind of a superstitious viewpoint about God, and if that works for you, that's fine." Kind of listened to that and thought, yeah, okay, if that's working for you, but superstition for educated people, usually you can get away with it for a while, but at a certain point it starts to wear thin. And I worry about people who, because I had that kind of higher power in my early recovery, but after a while, it just, my intellect came back. And so I thought, well, I should send him my book. And then I thought, no, don't bother. But in my first book that Rob so kindly spoke about, it was really kind of a wide-ranging exploration for me of the things that I had come to understand through my own practice and through my own recovery and through teaching Dharma, teaching Buddhist practices. And certainly I address the question of higher power because it's one that's so common with people in 12-step programs and especially with people who are drawn to Buddhism who are in 12-step programs, because it seems that a lot of people that are drawn to Buddhism are drawn to it because there isn't a God in Buddhism, technically speaking. And I found that, you know, after that book came out, I started to be invited to teach a lot more, and I found that despite my best efforts, people still were not satisfied that I had covered the topic. So thus my second book, which is wholly about the concept of higher power from a Buddhist perspective. And in fact, one of the questions, one of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, is an English Theravadan monk, asked me when he saw the title, the subtitle, Dharma, God, and the Path of Recovery, was, did you leave out a comma between Dharma and God? And indeed I did not. My intention was to bring those two together and to imply that actually they have the same meaning, that they can have the same meaning. And my hope was also to upset some people, partly a marketing ploy. You know, if you can get people upset, then they start to talk about it and write about it, and then, you know, then you become a controversy. It's like, you know how they do it with the movies. They'll have some scene that's really inappropriate, and then there'll be like a controversy that the production company will say, you've got to take that out, we can't release it, we can't get an R rating, and that way they get all this press about it. They probably never even had a scene like that. They just said that they did. So, unfortunately, my strategy didn't work. I'm not much of a marketer, but nonetheless, the book makes the points that I wanted to make, and I'm very happy with the book. And so I just thought I would read a little bit of it since we're in a bookstore. Really read the kind of the heart of the opening of the section that's called Dharma God. A few years ago, I was at Spirit Rock Meditation Center on their family retreat, a kind of Buddhist summer camp for kids and their parents. Here, the young people learn about Buddhist values, get a taste of meditation, sing, dance, and explore the beautiful natural surroundings of this Northern California center. During certain parts of the day, everyone comes together in the great meditation hall. Then at other times, the kids go off with counselors for their own activities, and the adults spend time with the Dharma teachers. One afternoon, a parents' group met with Ajahn Amaro, an Englishman who has been a Theravadan monk for over 30 years. Ordained by the great Thai master Ajahn Chah, Amaro is charming, lucid, and a great example of the wisdom and serenity these teachings promise. A grandmother, who'd never been to a Buddhist center before, asked him the fundamental question, "Is there a God in Buddhism?" I felt a moment of anxiety. If a Theravadan monk, particularly Ajahn Amaro, who'd been an important teacher for me, contradicted my thinking, it would create a lot of conflict for me. But he turned to her with his sly smile and said, "Buddhism is all about God." I breathed out in relief. Certainly, this answer wasn't the conventional understanding of Buddhism's relationship to the God idea. More typical is Walpola Ruhula, who in What the Buddha Taught, says that the idea of God is a human construction, and that, quote, according to Buddhism, our ideas of God and soul are false, and empty, unquote. Sorry, I had to throw in that little accent there. I find myself agreeing with both Amaro and Rahula. The distinction, I think, is between common ideas of what the word God means and a more mature viewpoint. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who I mentioned in the introduction, he was a Thai meditation master, 20th century. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu talked about this distinction. He said, as long as people insist that God is a person in the conventional sense of people language, we can say that they will not know the real God. Buddhism isn't about a deity or godhead that we worship, but it is about seeing the truth, and the truth is God. The word for truth in Buddhism is Dharma, Dhamma in Pali, the language of the earliest Buddhist texts. Dharma is at the heart of what I'll talk about as God, but the word truth alone isn't specific enough to help us. There are many aspects of Dharma, of truth, that fulfill different aspects of our understanding of God. As I explore God, I'll look at each of these individually. Buddhadasa talks about God being nature and the laws of nature, that which exists, and the rules that govern that which exists. Step 2 in the 12-step tradition calls God a power greater than ourselves. The laws of nature are clearly this: powers beyond our control. Buddhadasa rejected the idea that some religions are theistic and others non-theistic. He said that some religions personify God and others don't, but that the essence of God was not to be found in the, quote, outer shell and form of those religions, but in the universal truths that religions share. When we think that God is a human or even superhuman being, or in fact any kind of being, we can't help but attribute human qualities to him. First of these is gender. When God is a him, it creates a certain bias. At one of my early workshops on Buddhism and the 12 steps, one of the women participants expressed the pain of the ideal of a male god caused her. I was abused by my father as a kid. That made having a male god completely intolerable for me. For some time, her solution was calling God her. And there are many traditional sources for a female god. But while a female god might solve the problem for some people, it still leaves us with a human figure. I enjoy following professional sports, and there seem to be a lot of religious athletes. When I hear them talking about God helping their team or inspiring their performance, I have to wonder what they are thinking. If they mean that God has sided with them, then there's a problem. I cannot accept the idea that the creator of the universe is a fan of a certain sports team and not of others. I read about one player, though, who said he prayed for both teams, that no one would be injured and that all the players would play to their potential. Ah, I thought, here is wisdom. When I told one friend that I objected to the idea of false gods, that I thought it was about my God is better than your God, he told me that rather than taking the first commandment literally, thou shalt have no other gods before me, he found it to be a powerful image of his addiction. His false god was alcohol. He lived for that god. He turned his will and his life over to that god. Here was more wisdom. His point helped me to see through the superficial concepts and language of religion to the more vital spiritual meaning. For many of us, skepticism is a wholesome response to growing up in a culture rife with religious hypocrisies. And as we confront the conflicts between our scientific understanding and the myths presented as facts in religion, God, as he is offered to us, becomes a less and less palatable idea. As Buddhadasa says, the intellectuals will increasingly deny this ordinary kind of God, and it will not be long before people educated in the modern way will have eliminated God from their hearts altogether. Clearly, Buddhadasa sees the rejection of mythological religious beliefs as wise and appropriate. M. Scott Peck, in his book The Different Drum, says that the rejection of formal institutional religion is a stage of spiritual development. He says that those in this stage of skepticism are actually more developed spiritually than those who, however devotedly, adhere blindly to religious beliefs. These skeptics are the people who Buddhadasa says have eliminated God from their hearts altogether. And while this stage may be more developed than blind faith, it can be a very difficult and painful place to be. When we've rejected our traditional faith, without replacing it with anything, the world and life can be pretty dark. And this is a typical place for an addict, alcoholic to be. Such people often live in bitter cynicism about religion and about a lot of other things. Their addiction has dulled their hearts. The density of their thoughts won't allow in the subtlety of the spiritual experience. While it's true that the meditative experience is not intellectual, it's also not anti-intellectual. The spiritual life recognizes the limits of the intellect. We see its role in life, but we don't see it as the only way of understanding the world. If the true religious believer thinks that she knows all the answers, and the skeptic rejects all faith, then the spiritual seeker is in between. Don't know. Open to possibilities. The spiritual experience isn't one of filling ourselves up with either religious or intellectual beliefs, but of emptying ourselves so that we can experience what is directly, unfiltered. This is what the Buddha did and what he taught. He too rejected the religious notions of his time. He dismissed the Brahmanic rituals as empty and missing the essence of spiritual truth. And he wasn't satisfied with the mystic teachings that could only offer temporary respite from samsara, the round of suffering. The Buddha applied a penetrating intellect to the problem, and he applied a penetrating practice. Only by combining the two could he uncover the basic problem that held back all spiritual seekers, the persistent craving behind our suffering. Seeing suffering and understanding its cause led him to the solution, simply put, letting go. The Eightfold Path that he taught then was a formula for learning to let go in all aspects of life. What we can see in the Buddha's journey and in the journeys of all spiritually developed people is that skepticism is an essential part of the path, one that can energize and inspire us. However, it can also hinder us if we see it not as a place from which to explore, but rather as a destination. To return to the question, does Buddhism have a God? The answer is, it depends. It depends on what you call God. If you feel bound to the mystic version of the Abrahamic tradition of the dominant Western religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, then of course Buddhism doesn't have that God, since it didn't grow out of that tradition. But if you are open to the possibility that all religions are essentially looking for truth, and that the ultimate truth is God, then Buddhism certainly does have God. Some people will object to this definition, like the skeptics who come to Buddhism to get away from God. But as Karen Armstrong points out, definitions change. That's the nature of language and the human mind. Isn't God the power behind everything? And isn't that what the Dharma is? It may take some rewiring of our cognitive processes, for instance, using the word it to refer to God. But soon we might be able to accept that God is not some bearded figure reaching out of the clouds to bring life to Adam, but something more subtle, complex, and real. So that's kind of an introduction to the ideas. What I attempt to do in the book is then go on to take kind of key principles of Buddhism, starting with the law of karma, then going through the Eightfold Path, the quality of loving kindness, many of these kind of key principles of Buddhism, and talk about them as powers. And in a way, what I found as I was working on the book was that rather than trying to write a book that was about theology or really convince people that this was God, that the Dharma was God, ultimately what I was trying to do was look at step three from the 12 steps that says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And leaving out the word him, I was trying to see if it was possible for me to turn my will and my life over to these things. What it would mean to turn my will and my life over to, for instance, the power of karma. And what I arrived at, or what I arrive at, is the idea that when we commit ourselves to live by these principles, by these powers, like the power of karma, like the power of love, like the power of mindfulness, that we are turning our will and our life over to these principles, trying to live in harmony with them. When we live out of harmony with them, when we are not mindful or we are not loving, when we are self-centered, we're not turning our life over to these powers or to these principles. And that seems to work as an idea for working the steps. It doesn't require any kind of belief system beyond really our direct experience, although there's always that trusting in the process, trusting that if I do the right thing in this moment, the ultimate result will be positive. That's the faith involved, and which is really a trust in the law of karma. So that's kind of the setup.
So I have a question about...
Good.
As I understand what you're describing, in this 12-step program, there's reference to a higher power, which in the normal embodiment tends to map onto the Judeo-Christian God.
Right.
And maybe my sense of that is that there's an implication of a kind of a fear factor in there, or there's sort of a humbling through fear that, you know, you better watch out because things are outside of your control. Whereas in what you're describing, it feels more, you know, it appeals more, it's a little more neutral in that regard.
Yeah.
It definitely does not appeal to fear as much as it appeals to, you know, refuge as power, that there's something that can provide a support. And I'm curious if in your experience, if you see, you know, first, do you agree with that, what I'm supposing, that's partly my own projection, but do you see that your approach functioning differently for people?
Yeah, I do see it functioning differently for people, and essentially I agree with what you're saying. I mean, you're kind of describing the difference between commandments, which if you break them, you're committing a sin. Whereas in Buddhism, we have precepts, which are considered to be trainings. You're trying to train yourself to live in that way, but you understand that you're not going to always succeed, so there's kind of a built-in forgiveness factor. Ultimately, though, I think they're talking about the same thing. And I think it's just the way that sin has been kind of expressed or understood in our culture, that has made it into something that's kind of black and white. But when you look at the law of karma, it's pretty much saying the same thing in terms of if you do bad stuff, bad things are going to happen to you. It's kind of the same thing like if you commit a sin, but it's portrayed differently. And I would also say that the way we portray Buddhism in Western culture is different from the way it's understood in Asia. That there's a lot of magical thinking there in Asian cultures that boil down to a very similar kind of guilt scenario. I teach a class at St. Mary's College in their Jan term on Buddhism, and I had a Taiwanese Buddhist, a woman, in the class, and when she found out that I eat meat, she was shocked. And it was clear that to her, the fact that I ate meat was bad, and that I was creating really bad karma for myself, that that was going to, you know, who knows how I was going to be punished in, you know, the next lifetime. You know, so it all, it kind of just different. I think the subtext is very much the same, but that Western teachers try to present karma in a, you know, gentler way so as not to alienate people that are used to that kind of Protestant guilt trip. The bottom line to me is that if you do bad stuff, bad things are going to happen to you, whether you think of that as, you know, in your afterlife or whether it's going to, you're going to get run down by a truck, which I, that's not how I believe that works, but you know, that there are there's a price to be paid for being selfish, self-centered, and harming others, and it, but it, and it's just the way it's portrayed, and but yeah, I mean, it is important how we sell these things, but I fear sometimes because I think I'm in certain ways I'm a right-wing Buddhist. I'm not, you know, I'm not your typical right-wing Buddhist, but which usually the right-wing Buddhists are, you know, kind of going by the text and
meat eaters.
What'd you say?
Meat eaters.
Well, right.
The left wing eats soy.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that could be true too. Yeah. But the way that I am kind of a right-wing Buddhist is that I really believe in morality as the foundation of practice, and that was something that I learned the hard way, because when I started to practice Buddhist meditation, I was still drinking and using, acting out sexually, and just living a classically alcoholic addict life, and thinking that I could transcend all that or fix all that just by my spiritual practice, which is called spiritual bypass. And when I got sober and then came back around into my Buddhist practice in a more straightforward way, I found that my practice progressed and deepened very clearly, because I wasn't living in that way anymore.
So did you just suddenly feel like you were not living in denial anymore? Don't you feel that there's a way of denying when you're in an addictive place?
Yeah.
Saying, I'm not an addict, or...
Right.
I don't know, it's like, there's...
Yeah.
People just keep going on.
Yeah, and there's a whole kind of... stream of spirituality that's about, not about, but includes, oh, you can be drunk and enlightened. And Trungpa Rinpoche is kind of the leader of that movement, if you're familiar with him. You know, I just don't buy it. You know, I think it's possible to have what's called an enlightenment experience while you're still an addict, but I'm not really interested in it, and I don't really. It really kind of puts the lie to the idea that enlightenment is some final resting point that transcends everything. Anyway, we've already entered into controversial territory. Yeah.
I studied Buddhism in Korea, and I had the same observation that you made about for the vast majority of Korean Buddhists, Buddhism is going to the temple, praying to the Buddha,
right,
or a Bodhisattva, usually a Bodhisattva, but sometimes Shakyamuni, for a list of...
Right.
Thing.
And make sure you make a donation while you're at it.
And then you make a donation. Yeah. And a really intense belief in karma.
Yes.
And I had a realization when I was in Korea that I would never have the intuitive feeling about karma that they had, who kind of grew up in it. Mm-hmm. can I give an example?
Please.
I'm leading to a question.
It's fine. Go ahead.
Where a woman and her daughter had been grabbed by pickpockets on the street of Seoul, and they had been thrown down and got a broken arm, which is very unusual, and that's how it got on the news. You know, and they asked her about it, and she said, "Oh, I must have done something really bad to you know,
yeah.
my husband." You know, like,
right.
You know, like that's the only explanation that made sense to her.
Right.
You know, like, and she was, you know, like, so. The question I'm leading up to, and you sort of hinted at it, is the presentation of Western Buddhism, you know, like, is very psychological and leaves out, I mean, so much, like, leaves out prayer, for example, you know, like, and how do you feel about that? Or, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism is like really, really different from Thai Buddhism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, so
right.
I'm not saying that it's wrong that Western Buddhism is doing that, but I see a certain trajectory in Western Buddhism that's quite different.
Well, it's apparent when you see the different schools of Buddhism, which at one time, you know, grew so far apart that they didn't know about each other.
Right.
That Buddhism tends to take on the color of the culture and the flavor of the culture in which it arrives. It's not sort of imposing itself in a way. It's not an evangelical religion. I think, is that the right word? You know, Western Buddhism is maybe not even in its infancy yet. It may still be in utero, for all we know. But it's certainly not beyond its infancy. So it's figuring out what it's going to be, and clearly it's going to be influenced by psychology, and that's just a natural mix for us. And certainly we've dropped a lot of the ritual. And there are, you know, Asian Buddhists who actually are looking to the West to reinvigorate Buddhism in Asia. What I really appreciate is the, and what I think is important, is the breadth of what Buddhism means in the West now. So that, you know, up in Ukiah there's the Abhayagiri Monastery, which is where Ajahn Amaro was the co-abbot for many years. And they follow, they try to live the way the Buddha lived as best they can with their computers and iPhones. But, you know, they follow the 227 precepts. You know, they, you know, it's very traditional, and they consider themselves to be keepers of the tradition. And I am deeply, deeply grateful and respectful of them. And I can't do that. So I really appreciate that both they are doing that, and that they also are okay that there's other stuff. I mean, I, one breath at a time, Ajahn Amaro read the whole manuscript before it was published. I asked him to read it and to tell me if there was anything that he felt was off, that I didn't want to be portraying Buddhism in a way, because I knew I was making some kind of new connections that hadn't necessarily been made. And he was totally supportive of it. He didn't ask me to change a thing. He suggested some additions and clarifications, but that was great to me, because there was this deeply traditional practitioner who was also really open to the flowering of Buddhism in the many ways that it is flowering. So we have the Jon Kabat-Zinn school that doesn't even mention Buddha, and then we have the that whole range, and that's what I think is great. And so we don't have to feel constricted. We can kind of make our choice. What works for us? How involved do we want to be? How what do we believe? And now there's all these tech. You know, people are you know, doing commentaries on the ancient texts and translations that we didn't have available till fairly recently, and they'd be getting these scholarly things, and it's just a really exciting time to be studying Buddhism. Great. You know, coming back to the question of karma, it's a really tricky question. And one of the things the Buddha said was that if you try to unravel your own karma and understand why something happened to you or why something is happening to you, that you will go crazy. Don't go there. And he said, that's not the point. You know, what has happened before is gone. The only way you can affect your karma is in this moment. This is the moment when you are creating karma. And so live skillfully in this moment, and everything will take care of itself. You know, is it past lives? Is it just that that person was drunk? You know, I'm definitely of the liberal school around karma. And what I like to point out to people is that it's so interesting to me that the thing that people seem to think about karma mostly is external stuff, like I had good karma so I got a job, or I had bad karma so I got sick. Besides the fact that, you know, the kind of guilt that could turn into, oh, I got cancer, what did I do wrong, kind of thing. I mean, that's just crazy making. What people seem to overlook is that what's really important is how you're feeling right now. Are you happy right now? Or are you unhappy right now? And seeing how what you do, that is your thoughts, words, and actions, is what causes, you know, has the most effect on how you feel right now. And so if you're doing skillful, wise actions, you tend to feel better. And that's the karma I'm interested in. I'm not really interested in, like, do I get a bigger house or, you know, sell more books? And, you know, these are nice things, but, but, you know, moment by moment, how do I feel and what am I doing? Am I in harmony with the law of karma now? And how, you know, that's what is vital to me. So to me, emotional karma is more important than all the rest of it. You know, all the, what did I do in my past lives or what's going to happen in my next life? Don't know. You had your hand up before. Did I answer your question?
I'm interested in your journey, in hearing more about your own journey out of the addict's life. And also, I'm interested in what makes an addict come to you for help, and how do you help them?
Well, I'll try to answer the first thing second thing first. First of all, I guess when I started writing One Breath at a Time, I thought my audience was people who had been sober for 10 years, who had kind of come to a dead end, spiritual dead end, where were looking to deepen their recovery. And when the book came out, I started hearing from all these newcomers who were saying, oh, thank you so much, because now I can do the 12 steps. I couldn't stand those meetings until I read your book. So I think apparently one of the things that draws people to me is an alternative view of the 12 steps. Because certainly if you read the 12 steps and the 12-step literature without any context, or maybe even with context, it reads like this kind of Protestant screed, you know, and maybe not a screed, but that's the word that jumped to mind. I must have heard it recently. And
because of your karma.
Yeah. I think it was the radio I listened to today. And the thing is that the literature was written in the 1930s, what's happened to our country spiritually, the culture of our spirituality or culture of our religion in this country, how it's changed in the last 75 years is just incredible, really. Maybe it's not incredible, because maybe if you look at other historical periods that would happen too, but we've gone through a lot, and the 60s were the kind of turning point. So it's hard for people who don't have any kind of, and so many people these days I discover don't have any religious background. They're brought up with nothing. I mean, I was raised Roman Catholic, and I was baptized in First Communion and in Confirmation, and I was an altar boy, and, you know, I had that whole structure that I could destroy when I became a teenager. A lot of people, they don't have anything. So they come in and say, well, what do I do? I don't know, what's God? You know, I had visions of God, but as crazy as they were, at least I had something. So, you know, people, so that's one reason people come to work with me. People come to work with me because they want to learn meditation. And that's part of the 12 steps. The 11th, yes, the 11th step says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. The word meditation kind of jumps out of that step for a lot of people. It did for me when I came, because I was into meditation, and so I felt that I was like, okay, at least I can do that part of it. But a lot of people, there's no instruction in the 12-step literature because it's non-denominational. So a lot of people then seek out Buddhism because it seems like a trustworthy place to learn meditation. And then just simply, because I'm offering kind of a doorway into a spiritual practice, in generally speaking, recovery is really seen as a spiritual path, spiritual journey. Not everybody accepts it as that, but a great many people in recovery do. And again, the 12-step literature offers sort of one model for that, but it doesn't necessarily give like a full path that sort of something like Buddhism, a tradition as rich as Buddhism, offers. Well, that's a little of it. In terms of my own journey, you know, I write about that quite a bit, particularly in One Breath at a Time, because you know, the 12-step tradition is to tell your story. If you go to an AA meeting or an NA meeting or an OA meeting, very often there's a speaker who tells the story of their addiction, their journey from addiction to recovery. And since I was trying to blend Buddhism and the 12 steps, I thought part of that's going to be telling my own story, but not as a recover, not as a, you know, the kind of traditional recovery book that just tells that story, but really I just pull out pieces of my story that fit with the points that I want to talk about, so I don't tell it in a linear fashion. What do you want to know?
That's a good question.
I mean, I'm an open book, as they say.
It just seems so mysterious how mm-hmm. 1 year you'll be living an addict's life and the next year not. It's very mysterious.
Good. That's a great question, and it's something that I like to address because I think it's really an important question. The traditional view, and you get this in meetings, in 12-step meetings a lot, and it's a somewhat of an unspoken view, but it's pretty much a subtext for a lot of people, is that before you get sober, you're bad. You're bad. You're an alcoholic. You're an addict. Whatever you are, you're just bad. And then one day, you see the light, and you become good. And, you know, that works through for certain models, you know, the redemption model, the model of grace. My viewpoint, that doesn't make sense with the Buddhist model of karma, which is about cause and effect. It's not about some intervention of some external power that turns you from bad to good. So what I have realized with my own journey, and then have generalized that to into kind of saying to people, is this not true for you as well, is that there was always the dark and the light, there was always the good and the bad wrestling in me, that I always had a spiritual longing. It was there as a child, saying Mass in Latin that I didn't understand. In fact, I liked it more when I couldn't understand it, because there was some spiritual mystery to it. When I found out what they were actually saying, I was like, God,
I felt exactly
ridiculous. Anyway, but there was this longing, and it was expressed in a lot of confused ways, and this is not my original, this is not an idea original to me, but it becomes clear that addiction itself is a kind of misguided spiritual longing, an expression of a misguided spiritual longing. I mean, just as we see that, you know, taking drugs for a lot of people in the 60s was this kind of effort to have some transcendent experience. And for some people, that was opening, and it wound up being, the beginning of something. For most of us, it just was like, oh, let's find something else. And we went from acid to speed, you know, which was like, okay, you can make a claim about acid being spiritual, but speed? No, I don't think so. Not unless you're just saying your prayers really fast. Oh, it's, you know, so when you hear the Tibetans doing their mantras, it might work for them. But I see that when I look back at my life, I see that there was this journey that was happening all along. And I started meditating when I was 28. I didn't get sober till I was 35.
So being an addict was actually an important part of your spiritual journey?
Yes. And as much as it led me in the wrong direction, it was also, when you're high, there's this heightened experience, there's sometimes this more immediate, certainly marijuana, which was in some ways my drug of choice, really is a way of kind of being more alive. You know how music sounds when you're stoned, how food tastes when you're stoned? It's because there's this heightened awareness, and it's kind of what people are pursuing in spirituality.
So why is it a problem to be addicted, say, to marijuana as your spiritual... I'm just putting this down.
Why is a problem to be addicted to marijuana?
Yeah, like, if somebody
Have
was
you
saying,
ever tried smoking marijuana every day for 9 years?
I was with somebody who was doing it multiple times daily, and
yes.
To him it just helped him to relax and function. I'm trying to get... I was always trying to twist my brain around because I hated being stoned. I hate it. Totally doesn't work for me, but I guess
right.
For some people...
It's certain personalities really drawn to it.
And so...
When I look back at how I lived when I was high all the time, there were several problems. And it's founded in the fact that marijuana does make you sensitive in a way. The word hassle came into the culture at the same time that marijuana came into the culture. Do you remember that, anybody?
No.
Remember, before the mid-60s, nobody ever said, it's a hassle, man.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Because when you're stoned,
Everything's a hassle.
Because the heightened perception is pleasant when the perceptions are pleasant.
Oh,
but when they're unpleasant, it's even more unpleasant.
Oh,
so
the word that came in was wow.
Well, yeah, there's that.
It was fantastic.
Yes.
It was
so but the problem that arises, what happens is that there's a tendency then to avoid the difficult.
Ah, yes.
And things that are difficult include things like work, dealing with relationships, dealing with troubling emotions, mm-hmm. trying to grow emotionally. So I found that my career was kind of stymied. I never really had a career. I was a musician, but I just got along. My emotional development was pretty much stalled at age 14, 15. Mm. Maybe I started smoking pot when I was 17, so maybe we'll give me 17. So there was this passivity born of that sensitivity. So that's my understanding of marijuana, which I've thought about quite a bit.
Yeah.
I loved marijuana. When I smell it, still, a certain longing arises.
But not a burning desire?
not a burning desire, no. Thankfully. That was removed. And that's where the grace, and this is where what's remarkable is, as you said, that, and for me this happened in a very radical way, and I know of many people this happens. The day I woke up and decided I wasn't going to drink and use anymore, it was over. I never had the desire, any strong craving or obsession to drink or use again. And there was a long build up to that. You know, there was a struggle. I had been doing spiritual practices for many years. I had tried to stop various things. And 6 months before that, the woman I was living with basically said, "You're an alcoholic. You know, here, take this test. It's called the 20 questions." And yeah, according to that thing, I was an alcoholic. So it was in my face, you know, and I was like, "No, I'm not, and I'm going to show you, and then I'm going to control it." And then, you know, 6 months more of binging, and then getting fired, as I described. You know, I was 35 and I was making less money than I made when I was 16 as a musician. I got fired from the worst gig I'd ever had. It's like, wow, I couldn't even keep that crummy gig. That was my bottom, you know, for me. Even though I'd had worse moments in my life, but that was just like, I'm done. And it is mysterious how that happens in a way. And I understand why people say, well, it was grace that happened. But this is another way in which I had this debate actually on stage with another Buddhist teacher, one of my teachers, when I was talking about this stuff with his group in Berkeley. It's a big group that he has every Thursday night, James Barrison. And I was insisting that recovery was a karmic process and that there was a cause and effect. And someone raised their hand and said, "Well, when I got sober, I really didn't do anything. It was really just grace that allowed that to happen." And I objected to that, and James objected to my objecting to that. So, no, I think sometimes there is kind of a grace and stuff. And I just kind of go, where, you know, if everything is caught, if you believe in the law of karma, if you believe that everything has a cause, then everything has a cause. And grace, which is presumably has no cause, you know, it just happens, then if you allow that in, if you allow in one exception to the law of karma, then basically you're blowing up the law of karma. You're saying it's not true. It's just sometimes true, or usually true. Well, then it's never true. That's as far as I'm concerned. There's no proof for it at all, then. Now, is it possible that there are powers that I don't know about? Duh. You know? Yeah. I mean, is it possible that something that you would call grace exists? Yeah. But I still believe that something causes it. You know, it doesn't.
So that day that you woke up and it was over was not a moment of grace?
Well, it's certainly a nice poetic way of describing it. But what the way I really think of it is the two energies in my life, the energy of addiction and the energy of non-addiction, had been fighting it out. And for all those years, from 17 to 35, the energy of addiction had, the karmic power of the addiction had been stronger. And finally, the karmic power of the non-addiction overcame it. And that's a black and white moment, as there are many black and white moments in life. But that doesn't mean it all happened right then. When you graduate from college, they give you a degree, but that's not when you earn it. You had to go for 4 years, and if somebody who doesn't understand college goes, it's like the Wizard of Oz, right? Here's your diploma or whatever. You know, when he gives your brain, and if I only had a brain, what does he give?
Scarecrow.
Yeah, what does he give him?
He gives him a diploma.
Yeah. So, that's. You know, if you imagine that was how the world worked, you know, that'd be great. Okay.
But even in the Wizard of Oz,
we've gotten to the Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz. it was a symbolic transaction to reflect work that had already been accomplished by the scarecrow.
Exactly.
That's really.
Well, you're defending the law of karma, actually.
I am.
Yes,
and it's embodied in the Wizard of Oz.
Right. but if you understood it on a superficial level, you would think, you know.
Right.
No, but absolutely right. People do understand that it does mean that.
Well,
he already had it.
Actually,
he was already kind of smart.
The token was a way to get the scarecrow to consciously recognize the accomplishment of the episode.
Nice. Thank you, Stuart. One more question, and then they got to go home. Well, it's Thursday.
Right. I was glad to see you haven't touched on the fact that we live our lives now as humans in this epoch as intellectuals. We are industrialized, modernized. So one of the positive aspects that I wanted to bring up about drugs was that you mentioned the 60s and the drug taking and everything. The 60s is very dear to me because
me too.
I met Timothy Leary at the White Horse Saloon in downtown Manhattan when I had a career in the theater. And I just happened to go with some friends in there, and he was giving a talk like this. And he was still a Harvard professor. And, you know, with this suit,
yeah, sure.
Straight. And he said that he had discovered this substance, which, you know, lysergic acid.
He started with psilocybin.
Yeah. And, but it was, I remember the training that he said in the talk. He said, if you're going to take this path, you have to prepare yourself.
Right.
For the delusions of your imbalance. But he said the advantage, positive, why the turn on to the drop out. The drop out wasn't really the drop out of the establishment, which it became misunderstood.
Right. Yeah.
It was the drop out of the delusion that we are living, we're alive and this living in this life and our next moment, this is the most important to us, our greed and our ambitions and whatever happenstance that comes along. And that if we took this drug, that it, I don't know if it's the correct today, but the, at the time it sort of anesthetized the lower chakras of ourselves, that were obstructing our true, or the karmic guard that you talked about, is obstructed by all this chaos and the hassles that we go through in the day. And when we took it, this is what you were to aim for.
Right.
You weren't to put on, you know, the Beatles, you know, and get off, you know,
right.
Or screw all the ladies that were, you know, gullible over the stuff, you know. And I went along with them with the idea that we started taking more mics and more and more, very high. And what I found out, which doesn't exist today, but there's a thing called Kairos time, which is the a certain time where something like a crucible of energy where it works.
Mm-hmm.
And when we took it, you had the visions of things that were true. You know, that's where you go, wow.
Yeah.
Om, I remember my one friend, he just, Om Diddy, you know, and I knew he was right in it.
Yeah.
And you could ask him anything, and you would get the greatest truths or whatever it was. But then it would wear, this was the curse of drugs.
Little
you
problem,
would start to go on the down elevator.
Right.
And you would come out, and what was I? And all he could tell is, he says, the only thing that you brought back is that you knew something happened.
Yeah.
Okay. But you didn't quite know.
Right.
And he says, try to, and this is what happened with the Dago paint and drawing on the walls. You'll be stoned. Draw this. Oh, there, I see this thing up here, and you draw, and or like this lady friend of mine, she would write reams and reams and reams of papers stacked of all everything.
Mm.
And then when we came down, and it was all gone.
Yeah, no.
You know, like,
right.
But we got stoned again. This is the point that was incredible. You got stoned again, and you read it all.
Right.
It was the great
yeah.
doctrine.
You know,
when
I mean,
the crime and corruption entered
yeah,
that world,
yeah.
The purity of the being mentality
right.
and all there is love and you know, all that kind of stuff. The corruption came in, and then negativity and hassle
yeah.
entered very heavily.
Yeah.
And it was of no value. Now, my, what do you say in 12 step when you give your story, is that at that point, I automatically stopped. In other words, I went to my own one step plan.
Good for you.
Step. I just stopped because it wasn't right.
Right.
Never, you know, I couldn't trust long hairs anymore.
Right.
I couldn't, you know, nothing was right. All I saw is businessmen and on Haight Street making money off of, you know, tie-dye shirts and, then, you know, just doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the guys in the own this bookstore. And it's a kind of
thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah, really great.
But, you know, the
puppeteers.
puppeteers. Come around just for the money. But, I mean, I was a purist in that sense.
Well, I mean, it's clear that drugs have been used throughout history to create a transcendent experience, but and that they're used in a ritualized way.
Right,
and obviously,
yeah.
the Native American tradition, we see that. In the, you know, that
yeah, but see, that's the point I'm trying to bring up.
Yeah.
The thing, the main point of what I saw, what others were with me at that time, was that Christianity, Buddhism, Mohammedism, all the isms, all of them,
mm-hmm.
were of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were stoned, that the message you were to remember, and this one I didn't have to write down, I drilled in my head, there was something that happened in the moment
mm-hmm.
that was the real religion.
Right.
And it wasn't organized in
yep.
the sense that it was organized. It was a state you went into,
mm-hmm.
and that there was a teacher at another level,
mm-hmm.
Not a human teacher, and not a teacher that we knew of, but it was you, your guide or whatever,
yeah.
was actually channeling energy to you that was for you, and it was working on whatever you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to leave you with a question out of all that.
Okay.
The great thing that comes out in spiritual path is the dualism of being and becoming.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel, if you're on a spiritual path, are you okay the way you are, just be feeling groovy?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there like a little dirty spot, you know, a leopard with spots that have to be removed? Oh, well, this is a little like pride has to go, greed has to go.
Mm-hmm.
I got this other, you know, I say fuck too much, so I gotta get rid of that. You know, all these little, is behavior or just sitting and feeling groovy, are either one of these things a reality to consider?
Well, it's both and neither.
Okay. Light and dualism.
Yes. I mean, absolutely. You know, there is the relative reality that we live in and we have to deal with, and there are consequences for how we live in that. And there is also the absolute view that everything is just one, that this stuff, that this is, you know, this is all kind of just this temporary passing through illusory, it's not that it's not real, but it's not, there's nothing, no substance to it that's lasting. So to me, one of the keys to spiritual maturity is being able to hold the two views without becoming too enraptured with the material world, but also not getting too into the transcendent vision, so that you're not taking care of that relative reality, because then things fall apart. So holding those two is one of the qualities of spiritual maturity, I think.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that question. I'm glad I came up with a quick answer. And that you understand what I'm saying, so we're on the same level. That's great. I do really appreciate you guys,
thank
Stuart
you.
And Rob, and all of you for coming in.
On behalf of many rivers, I want to thank you. That was really wonderful. You did
not disappoint. And I want to point out to all of you that we have many copies of this new book, as well as of the old, and also that we have a donation bowl over there, the dana or donation that it accepts. We share with our speakers to support their work and also to support this space. So I encourage you to contribute to that. But don't miss your chance to have Kevin sign your copy of A Burning Desire or One Step. And thank you so much for coming tonight.
Okay.
Thank you.
I guess I should get out of pen. I forgot about what's up.